Hi, and welcome to Liberating Libraries, a project of the Conspiracy of Equality. In this series, we look at some of our favorite authors and how their fiction can inform, enhance, or guide our own thinking about the world and our activism. We believe that when done well, fiction foments invention. It is where we can try our hands at being attuned to alternatives. Sometimes it fails, and it is always imperfect. But at any moment, it can be a source of solidarity, equality, or freedom. In this episode, we discuss The Left Hand of Darkness and The Word for Worlds is Forest by the late Ursula K. Le Guin. The Left Hand of Darkness, which was published in 1969, follows the diplomat Jinri in the ice world of Genthin. He is an alien come to negotiate the entrance of Genthin into the Hainish universe and set up trade between them and the Ecumen worlds. He is assisted by Estervin, a Gathinian politician who trusts and believes him. The novel follows these two as they traverse the messy political worlds of Genthin's two major competing nations and their political and religious ideas in search of peace and friendship. The Word for World is Forest, published in 1972, and follows the conflict between the Ecumen, who have come to the world Athshe to log timber. Athshians, some of who are enslaved, must decide how to resist the occupation, which will introduce mass violence into an otherwise peaceful people. The story is told through the friendship between Lyubov, a human anthropologist, and Selvar, one of the leaders of the Athshians. The story builds on the themes of colonialism, primitive accumulation, resistance, and intergenerational trauma. All right, so why Ursula Le Guin? I came through Ursula Le Guin through you, as well as hers was a name that always kind of got dropped in a lot of like women's studies work that I did when my undergrad, though I had never read her beforehand. And I happened to come across these books in a used bookstore in Detroit a couple years ago when I was down there visiting a friend. I think she's a very interesting author. Like, I think she is a very prominent author in a field that was dominated by men in the 60s and 70s. The Left Hand of Darkness was the first book written by a woman to win both the Hugo and Nebula Awards, which are very prominent science fiction awards. And yeah, I think she just does some really interesting things of playing with gender, playing with international relations in her science fiction that open up a lot of ideas that don't necessarily get talked in traditional science fiction or traditional fiction anyways, that are important to approach and dissect and see what we can learn from them.
I think that's a really interesting way of putting it, that Ursula Le Guin is talking about international relations in a really interesting way, like not in a sort of boring IR boy kind of way. Or just, you know, in terms of wars or static security studies type things. She's really talking about international relations and the interconnections and the meetings of these species of humans through, like, trying to talk about how we approach the other and how we can actually approach the other in meaningful and productive ways. So maybe we can start there.
So why don't you give us a kind of background? So, like, what, like, how do you think she is starting to approach the other?
Well, I think in The Left Hand of Darkness, I think one of the things that compelled me the most, because like you, when I started reading The Left Hand of Darkness, I was kind of like, I don't really get this book. I don't really like the main character. I don't really like the story. Or there were things about the story that I was like, I don't know if I really want to read this. And then as it progresses, and especially in the when she finally moves to the two voices, where you've got the main character, Jenri, and the fellow from Carhide, Estraven, they're two voices, so in different chapters you'd get one of their perspectives and the other, and they're together and they're talking about their experiences of the journey together, you really get a sense of like how important it is, that process of coming to understand where people who are outside your language and your experience of the world are coming from. And using that to like build respect was one of the things that really appealed to me. So that whole, that as soon as that section started, I was hooked. Like that book just got me as soon as she started doing that, because it was just so profound the way that, you know, you could feel the barriers between those two people in being able to understand each other, but you could also feel the effort that they were both putting in to break those down. Which a lot of it, I think, had to do with the fact that they needed each other for survival. Yeah. And especially that Jenri needed Estraven to survive the journey that they were on in the middle of the book.
Like, I think that that is an interesting way of, like, thinking about how they do become able to trust each other. The one thing that I was kind of thinking when I was thinking about this point was, even though, like, their relationship really truly develops, Estraven trusts Jenri right from the get-go, right? Mm-hmm. Like, he is the one who is there trying to help him through every step of the way and trying to negotiate kind of, like, the difference in culture and what he shouldn't do and shouldn't do. Even though Jenri, at the beginning, does not trust Estraven at all. Like, he trusts him the absolute least. I guess, like, my question is, isn't so much, like, how that relationship is built, but, like, how do we be Estraven? Right? Like, how do we actually, like, put ourselves out there that we want to trust the other so much, even when they don't trust us?
But I don't know that Estraven is, like, Estraven's not a finished product at the beginning of the book. He has an arc. Like, yeah. Just because he maybe starts from a more trusting position than Jenri does, doesn't mean that he doesn't have an arc that develops mm-hmm. in terms of their relationship. Like, I agree with you. I think, actually, you're right. That is a really, that is right. That Estraven, it's not necessarily that he trusts him like a friend, but he believes him, mm-hmm. right? He believes him that he's from this place and that his intentions are what he says they are. And he works for him, but he also works for him behind the scenes, right? He doesn't tell Jenri what he's doing. He doesn't explain himself. And he gets himself exiled without Jenri understanding what is actually going on. And if that is where their story had left, there would have been nothing. Like, it's not like they had built anything, or he had built anything with Jenri. It's just that the story was left with him doing something for him, but not really explaining what he was doing. And I think, like, there's a few profound moments in their journey together. I mean, especially when Estraven starts calling him by his first name instead of calling him Mr. A or I, or however you pronounce it.
Yeah.
Right? I think, like, that's an important moment. And I think maybe you're right, because I think maybe the better way of saying it is, like, he starts off believing him, but by the end of the book, he's his friend and he trusts him.
Yeah.
And he loves him. And it's like that building of love is the thing about approaching the other that I think this book does so well, is talk about the role in a really interesting way, talking about the role of love in building our relationships with the other.
Do you think it's love that they feel with each other at the end of it? Or is it just like a kind of a deep friendship? Not that I necessarily know exactly if there is a difference between love and a deep friendship. And, like, is it necessary to parse kind of, like, that out, do you think?
I think it's not necessary to parse that out. Because I think that we, especially when we're reading stories, especially when we're accustomed to saying that love is romantic or love looks a particular way, we kind of exclude the possibility that love can exist in forms that we would call friendship. Because, like, I think, I think that there is no other word for what they end up with. Their ability to, like, feel each other and be empathetic to each other and also do all of this care work for each other by the end. I mean, by the end, Jenri is also caring for Estevan. It's not just Estevan caring for Jenri. And, like...
Yeah, absolutely it is.
Like, I don't think that it... Because I remember having this feeling while I was reading the book. I was like, oh my god, are they going to fuck at some point? and then being like, wait a minute, of course not, because that is not the point of their relationship. The point of their relationship is that it's love that isn't about our conventional ideas of love. It's love that's actually about care and empathy for another human being. So then what's the difference between... approaching the other in the left hand of darkness and approaching the other in the word for world is forest?
I think the biggest, I mean, like, they're very different stories, right? So the left hand of darkness kind of is that, you know, there's one person trying to come as an ambassador from this other world. Whereas the word for world for forest, it's really about a colonizing mission of coming into this world to basically take resources with no care for the life that exists on that planet.
Mm-hmm.
So, right from the beginning, like, there is kind of, like, no trust between the main parties, because there is, like, a very heavily militarized presence of the colonizers. But then there is the relationship between Selvar, who is a Kree, the people who are on the world to begin with, and Lyubov. I'm going to say
his Lyubov?
Name. Lyubov, yeah. Lyubov, who is a researcher, I think he's kind of like an anthropologist,
yeah.
On the kind of mission. And they develop a very close, like, friendship and relationship to each other. Both, they kind of, like, help each other out, and I think they're also just very just interested in learning about each other,
mm-hmm.
and taking the time to learn about each other. So, in the word for world is forest, what you have is finally the Kree-chees who don't do violence in their own culture. They have ways of dealing with conflict and fear nonviolently, organize themselves to fight back. And they do fight back, and it's very, very violent. And basically, they're just trying to get rid of everybody on, like, any non-Kree-chee, all of the humans on the planet they're trying to get rid of, until Selvar runs into Lyubov, and Lyubov gets mad at Selvar and is just like, what are you doing? You have to stop. You can't do this anymore. You're going to hurt yourselves.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's just this interesting thing, because, like, the Kree-chees have such a very strong kind of spiritual connection among each other. There's, like, really beautiful scenes where, as a way of kind of healing from the trauma of the colonizing, where, like, they have these grand kind of assemblies where they sing, and singing is a very healing thing for them that is slowly getting lost as they kind of do the war drive towards fighting with the humans. So you have this situation where Lyubov sees what's happening with the Kree-chees and is terrified by that in a way that Selvar doesn't actually see, until they meet and Lyubov is dying. And there's a scene where he just, like, it's just like, no, you have to go back now. You have to stop now. And it's in that thing, in that trust, that it's almost like Selvar understands that Lyubov sees what's happening that he can't see, that he does order the Kree-chees to stop killing, and eventually kind of organizes some type of loose peace treaty with the humans that are left on the planet to allow them to live until they can get off the planet and, like, live in some type of, like, kind of peaceful harmony, whereas the Kree-chees can go back to living their own lives and, like, trying to, like, practice their nonviolent traditions as well. The trust that is built by Lyubov just not being an asshole. Like, I know there's more to it than that, but it's just, like, Lyubov has a very deep interest in understanding the Kree-chees.
Mm-hmm.
And an interest not about building himself up or like trying to like figure out a way to find out what their weaknesses are, but he just has an honest curiosity about the way that they live, and a sincerity in doing so. Mm-hmm. Like he really like trusts what's happening. And Selvar, who, you know, his wife is raped and murdered by like the Colonel Davidson, who's the evil person in the story.
The antagonist.
The antagonist, yes. If we're using proper words. Layuba protects Selvar, who attacks Davidson, and it's the first time a Kriji had ever attacked a human, and was able to pull him off before Davidson killed him.
Yeah. Well, like, you're talking about how that trust is built, and I think it's mm-hmm. an important distinction between the two stories, that, like, in The Left Hand of Darkness, the main characters in the stories are also political actors and have political interests. And so you've got Estevan is the chief of staff or chief advisor to the king. I think that's his official. Or no, he's the president. And then therefore chief advisor to the king.
Yes, that's how it was.
And because of his support, and Jenri is this ambassador from the Hainish universe. I think it's also important that in The Left Hand of Darkness, there isn't actually an antagonist.
Mm.
Whereas in The Word for Wolder's Forest, there's clearly both, like, individual antagonists, like Davidson, who's just, you know, fucking insane. And, like, the, you know, paragon of toxic masculine colonizer. But then there's also, like, antagonism in the sense of, like, the structure of the type of colonization that's happening. Whereas Left Hand of Darkness is really much more about this, like, diplomatic clash that doesn't really have good or bad people. It just has people who have political interests and want to either maintain power or maintain normalcy or maintain, what's the word I'm looking for? Stability?
Mm-hmm.
In
the face of this great change.
Yeah, and so, like, they're both really realistic stories in the sense that we both have historical examples of, like, this kind of brutal colonization, and we have historical examples of, like, diplomatic conflict that isn't really about anybody being particularly bad, but about people, like, trying to negotiate change.
Mm-hmm.
So then I wonder if, like, the relationship between Lyubov and Selvar ends up being very different from the relationship between Estevan and Jenri, because their relationship both isn't sort of initially filtered through political interests.
No.
But it's also, like, that point in the book when Lyubov is like, I have to stop just being an anthropologist and actually do something because I've created this relationship, is sort of like, I don't know, to me, I don't know exactly, because it's like, there's a bit of romanticism, I think, on the part of Ursula Le Guin in terms of, like, romanticizing what an anthropologist could do.
Yeah.
Because, like, historically, this is not actually how the majority of anthropologists interact or become attached to like friendships with others, but also, yeah, like, she doesn't really tackle, like, the power imbalance between them.
No.
But then at the point when Lyubov is like, no, I actually have to do something. I had to become the activist anthropologist. I can't just be his friend. I also have to, like, I have to take a stand against what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think it's also the point, like, Lyubov is dying when he takes the stand, right? Like,
yeah.
He has been in the attack, he's been injured in the attack, that Selvar is actually really annoyed with him because Selvar warns him not to be there at this time, but Lyubov ignores him, and he's in the attack. Yeah. So I'll just read a little, kind of like, the interaction right as Lyubov is dying, so it's just right after the attack. So Selvar starts, Lyubov, why did you stay here? I told you to be out of the city this night. So Selvar spoke in a dream, harshly, as if he were angry at Lyubov. Are you the prisoner? Lyubov said, faintly, and not lifting his head, but in so commonplace a voice that Selvar knew for the moment that this was not the dream time, but the world time, the Force Nights. Or am I? Says Selvar. Neither, both, how do I know? All the engines and machines are dead. All the women are dead. We let the men run away if they would. I told them not to set fire to your house. The books will be all right. Lyubov, Why aren't you like the others? I am like them. A man. Like them. Like you. No, you are different. I am like them, and so are you. Listen, Selvar, don't go on. You must go back. To your own. To your roots. When your people are gone, then the evil dream will stop. Now, Lyubov said, trying to lift his head, but his back was broken. He looked up at Selvar and opened his mouth to speak. His gaze dropped away, and he looked into the other time, and his lips remained parted, unspeaking. His breath whistled and a little in his throat. As Selvar spoke to Lyubov, he said, "We'll go back," he said. "I will go back now. We will go back now. I promise you, Lyubov." Mm-hmm. So it's this really intense scene that, like, it's just after all of this violence, and there's just this little interaction between these two friends, these two, like, really good friends from these two different species, mm-hmm. that are able to change the course of, like, kind of the destiny that has been going on. That is what is happening to them, to protect both the Screechies from becoming something that he doesn't want them to become, as well as protecting the humans who are left on this world.
Yeah. I know this is probably derailing the conversation, potentially, but I wonder how you feel about, like, the sort of white savior complex implications of the story. Because I feel like that's also a distinction between Left Hand of Darkness and this, like, between the friendships that the books mm-hmm. are talking about, is that you can't really apply sort of racial, like, our racial histories or racism to the Left Hand of Darkness the way you can clearly apply it to the word for world is forest.
I mean, I think it's there, absolutely, but I don't think it falls into your traditional trap of the white savior, largely because that's really the only conversation that you could take apart to see that, right? Where it's as this friendship had been built, and, like, Selvar let Lyubov in on so much of the world, and he was able to see so much of the world that he was able to see when things were changing so drastically. So, and again, it's not him actually saving anybody. It's him having that conversation with Selvar, and Selvar on his own deciding that what is happening is wrong and goes against kind of, like, who the Creatures are. Mm-hmm. So, like, you're right. It is there. There is, like, definitely some very uncomfortableness there. But I feel like it doesn't fall into the same traditional trap that, like, a lot of white saviors are. Because, like, Lyubov dies, right? Like, he's not leading the Creatures to anything. He's not... He gets killed in the attack, just like all the other humans. But there's this brief interaction with Selvar, his friend, mm-hmm. that he is able to, like, talk to him and be like, "You have to stop doing this. You have to stop doing this because this isn't who you are."
Yeah, I agree. And, like, the fact that he very explicitly identifies himself as being one of these men and being mm-hmm. being like them, but then also challenging Selvar to think about how he's like them. And then I think the piece at the end when Selvar, the very last thing in the book, one of the sort of ambassadors from the other world comes and says, "We shall go. Within 2 days we shall be gone, all of us, forever. Then the forests of Athshi," which is what the Creatures call the world that they're on, is Athshi, which means forest, "will be as they were before." And Selvar says, "Lyubov will be here, and Davidson will be here, both of them. Maybe after I die, people will be as they were before I was born and before you came, but I do not think they will." Right? And it's like, Selvar is very, very aware of all of these consequences, and also, I think, it's not the infantilization of the sort of indigenous others that the white savior either protects or sacrifices himself for, and then they kind of are saved or protected. It's like, they're not being infantilized. They fully understand all these consequences, and he also, Selvar, clearly understands that that change has happened, and there's going to be some difficult conversations and difficult, like, times ahead to kind of think about how to negotiate that change.
Yeah, so the other part that I really liked about these two books is that there is a lot of change that happens in them, right? Like, change is everything. And I think one of the, like, videos that I've seen and one of the essays that I've read by her is she's interested in the idea of how can we talk about change that isn't kind of dystopian, right? So, and I like this idea, especially when, like, in our current context, when we look at, like, climate change, we look at nuclear disaster, we look at mass inequality,
fascism,
like, how can we talk about change for the better without thinking in terms of dystopia? And I'll be honest with you, I don't know if I can, right? Like, when I think of the ability to change things in the better, it's always in this, like, dystopian kind of nightmare that we can maybe start to build something new. Whereas in both of these books, change does happen, and not necessarily dystopian ways. Like the conversation we just had, where it's like on trust, and we have to figure out a way to trust the other and trust ourselves. But how can change happen?
Is she saying, like, the world doesn't need to collapse in order for us to change? Is that what she's saying?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what she's saying. Like, there has to be ways that things can change. Like, relationships can change. Both personal relationships and international relationships can change without things collapsing, without there being some type of, like, doomsday event that forces it to happen.
Yeah. I mean, because we've talked about how, like, a lot of the kind of science fiction that Ursula is writing about is about showing us things about our current world. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the things that you can take from both of these stories is that this is actually happening, and this is actually how change happens, that there's no static relations out there. At the end of The Word for World is Forest, you've got the reality that the world is never going to be the same.
Yeah.
And that even if the colonizers get up and leave, the world isn't going to be the same because the ways people have of relating to that world have been altered. Mm-hmm. But that songs can be rebuilt, right? Yeah. The healing can happen and the songs can be rebuilt.
So I think for me, I think the kind of where we're kind of talking across parts here is that I don't think Ursula's trying to be like, and I'm not trying to be like, how do we escape what's happening? But I think it's how do we change the trajectory of what's happening? So, like, yes, the Creechies absolutely are going to have to live with the history and the violence and the trauma that has happened. But at the same time, they were both able to sustain themselves. So ideally, this violence that had happened is going to slow or stop. And they also were able to stop killing other humans as well. So I guess for me, it's just like, I think that's, it's not about trying to escape what's happening, but it's about how do you change that trajectory so it ends better, so you can actually have a better ability to deal with these different problems and traumas that are that could happen. And I think that's what Ursula is more interested in. How can you facilitate change that allows you to move forward in some type of more wholesome or round way?
One of the things that you were saying that interested you a lot was the way that they choose to stop killing, right? Like, they could go and kill every single human on the planet, but they choose to stop. And that relates, in my view, that relates to, like, a practice that they have that they talk about at the beginning of the book, where amongst themselves, they do They do fight. Their fighting is actually not physical, but they do have confrontations. And the way that they stop confrontation is that one person lies down.
Yes.
And exposes their neck, so makes themselves the most vulnerable that they can be, and that's actually a way of communicating, like, essentially tapping out, right? Mm-hmm. Essentially saying, I want to stop this confrontation because I'm making myself so vulnerable that you can't kill me. Lyubov talks to the other humans about this as, like, there's this whole way in which what the Creechies are trying to do is communicate, like, we don't want you to keep hurting us. Please, like, stop hurting us by making themselves as vulnerable. And the humans interpret this as being stupid and as being, like, they have given up or they've acquiesced to our power. So at the beginning of the colonization process, you have, like, a bunch of Creechies, like, who are being beaten or raped or whatever. Just do this to be, like, I'm trying to communicate with you to stop. I'm trying to communicate with you that we need to stop this violence. Like, this is my language. This is how I know to do this. And it clearly doesn't work because the humans just use that. And there's also a point at which Lyubov talks about how if a Creechie does this with another Creechie, they can't kill them. Like, they don't have murder really in their society, but they also can't keep hurting them, right? Mm-hmm. Like, they're almost, like, socially and physically incapable of continuing to hurt somebody who's in this position, and the humans don't have that cultural language, and so they don't respond to it. So then at the end, like, the Creechies do their attack and they have all this violence. And then they find, I felt it was interesting because, like, they find a different way of deciding to stop that's using a new language to stop that I think kind of it's a way of actually seeing the arc of the change because they find a new way of communicating with the humans.
Yeah, and it's almost like they have to force the humans into exposing their vulnerability.
Mm.
Right? Where, so it's, yeah, it's like after kind of the first violence, the humans are forced into this position of negotiating, which they don't like. And it's like they always try to, like, make these big threats of, oh, we have all these weapons and blah, 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 we can still do all this harm to you. And the Creechies just don't buy it. They're just like, well, we can, like, look what we've done already. Like, we can continue.
Mm-hmm.
So the humans are then forced into this position of negotiation and discussion through the vulnerability. And that's the vulnerability of their very personal lives,
mm-hmm.
which they've never had to do because they've always had superior firepower, or, like, they've been able to figure out a way to not do that. So yeah, I think that's a really clever way of, like, seeing this type of language that they have created to force the humans to be able to communicate in the ways that they do.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And, like, it's kind of a little depressing in the fact that they have to use this, like, great amount of violence to force them into, like, this discussion. But at the same time, it works, right? It's like they are able to protect themselves to be able to live their lives going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Vulnerability is very important, and I think if we, like, look at the Left Hand of Darkness as well, like, it is when Jenri and Estervan become the most vulnerable that they are able to figure out some type of relationship and be able to, like, really the trust is really start to be built. So I do think, like, I think Le Guin is, like, trying to pick apart that and just be like that if we actually want to, like, trust isn't built through a position of strength, trust is built through a position of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
I think is a really deep and important way that we can look at trying to build relationships to combat, you know, the powers around us. That, like, if we actually want to be able to build an organization, it can't be one out of strength or just debate or common interest, but it has to be, like, about out of trust and out of vulnerability and trust that we have with our fellow organizers to be able to trust that we are going to be able to, like, do the work needed to combat these greater systems.
And take care of each other.
And take care of each other.
Left Hand of Darkness was written in 1969. It was published in 1969. So the language obviously is different maybe than the language we would use if this book were written today. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that that means that what it's talking about is like any less important or interesting or mm-hmm. like so problematic that we can't talk about it. So yeah, this was something that like fascinated me in the book, Left Hand of Darkness. So to sort of explain as quickly as possible, the humans who live on Gethem, on the planet that Jenri has come to, are what Ursula Le Guin calls ambisexs. And we could also think of it as them being like asexual. Between these sort of monthly times that they go through what they call chemering. And chemering is when they become sexual, or like when their sexuality comes out. So during their chemering, they can either become like biologically male or biologically female, and then they have sex, and any of them can carry children. So if you're a female during chemering and you become pregnant, then you carry the child, even if in your previous chemerings you were male. Mm-hmm. And the language around this is hard to talk about because it doesn't actually translate very well into like political language around sexuality and gender that we use in 2018. Like, it doesn't translate well into talking about asexuality or about trans identity or anything.
See, this is where I disagree. Like, so I think off the bat, I think I'm disagreeing with you. I don't think it's asexuality. I think it's, we don't have a language for it because it's a type of body that doesn't exist. Right? So like when we say ambisexual, when they're not in their chemering phase, they have neither reproductive organs. And they have no sexuality. And then during the time of chemering, they will take either like male or female organs, and they will have sex during that time. So like, I don't think it doesn't fit into the language we have because it's a body type that doesn't exist.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right.
Yeah.
You're right. And so like, that's really difficult for Jenri to kind of deal with, and he's also written as this like actually quite toxically male character. Like, he's very obsessed with the fact that he can't tell the difference, as he puts it, between men and women on this planet, and that like he's got some very like sexist ideas about the relationships between men and women, and he also thinks quite a lot about sex. Mm-hmm. And so he has a really hard time understanding ambisex, for different reasons than I have a hard time understanding it. And so like, he spends a lot of the book kind of trying to think about like the effect that this has, and thinking about it in these very sort of abstract, but also very like critical, he's got a very critical view of it. So then in the second part of the book, he and Estevan end up becoming fugitives together, and they're traveling over the ice together. It's a really dangerous journey, and they have to spend a lot of time in very vulnerable and close circumstances. And he starts to have a better understanding of what the actual like body that Estevan is in looks like and means to him or to them. Estevan is gendered male in the story by Jenri, but we can call mm-hmm. them a them. He actually comes to a place where he's able to see Estevan for who they are. And I just want to read the passage where that happens. Okay, so they're in the tent together, and they're just talking. And then Jenri says, "And I saw then again, and for good, what I had always been afraid to see, and had pretended not to see in him, that he was a woman as well as a man. Any need to explain the source of that fear vanished with the fear. What I was left with was, at last, acceptance of him as he was. Until then, I had rejected him, refused him his own reality. He had been quite right to say that he, the only person on Gethin who trusted me, was the only Gethinian I distrusted. For he was the only one who had entirely accepted me as a human being, who had liked me personally and given me entire personal loyalty, and who therefore had demanded of me an equal degree of recognition and of acceptance. I had not been willing to give it. I had been afraid to give it. I had not wanted to give my trust, my friendship, to a man who was a woman who was a man. And it's just, to me, that's just so profound. His ability to, the ability of Ursula Le Guin, I think, at all, to write a story arc that, first of all, creates this world with these terms, and then also tells this story of somebody coming to a place where they actually can see a person for who they are in a way, to a point where they can see them for who they are in a body that makes no sense to our to our understanding of what a body looks like. To me, that's really profound and really meaningful.
Yeah.
And says a lot about how we can approach gender politics better, and how we can approach how we can approach all kinds of otherness better, right? To see what is initially we think is unseeable about a person.
Yeah, it's that forced interaction to see kind of like the body politic, like to really understand our humanity in our bodies, and that our bodies are different, and like that matters, but it doesn't necessarily, it shouldn't matter in our ability to trust or understand the other person.
And it's not, but it's not just that, it's that being able to see somebody's body for, or somebody for who they are,
mm-hmm.
Without needing to apply your own binaries to them,
yeah.
For example, is also the mechanism by which you can come to like trust and love, right? Because I think that moment is also a big moment for the love story between them, which is a not a romantic love story. It's a different kind of love story.
Yeah, it is. It is a different type of love story.
It's the love story of emerging from the hostility and danger that change can produce. Emerging from that through having taken care of another person through that process.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what their relationship as a love story also challenges me to think about is like, can you have a real meaningful bond with another without love? And can you also have the ability to see others for who they are without love? But then I also am really torn about the gender story in this book. I have some feels about it. You're laughing at me. So I always have these feels. And my feel about this is, I think, especially the way we've just talked this out, I'm like, how profound what she's saying is really striking and really, I think, important. But then at the same time, I think about what it actually means for, like, the way we think about gender and the way that it's a very binary approach to gender still that is being, like, even though they have this, like, ambisex body, like there's a very binary approach to gender, and they also are really, really clear in the book that having sex between two men or two women is not something that they do. I can't help thinking, what then happens to the like two sexualities that aren't defined by heteronormativity?
I wonder, I don't know if that was Le Guin's point.
No, I know it's not her point, and I know it's not what she's trying to do, and I know that she's not trying to be, like, homophobic.
Yeah.
And I don't think that it is. It's just that the question that it raises for me is, like, what gets lost if we lose, like, sexuality that is not between men and women?
Like, I hear what you're saying. I don't think it's a fair thing to put on Ursula, because she's doing so much more, right? Because, like, I think she's trying to look at is what happens when we take the power relationships that are determined by gender and blow them up, right? So the conversation that we had just had about how Jenry finally sees Estevan as not either a man or a woman or a woman or a man, But what happens if Estevan would have been a woman? What does that relationship look like? So I think what she's trying to do is blow up this idea of this inability to trust somebody or develop a relationship to somebody because they're of a different gender. And the only way she's actually able to do that is by making them ambisex. I think that's like the question that she's trying to grapple with. And like, so what are we doing when power, which is so completely determined about between male and female, gets blown up, right? Because sexuality, and I think it also kind of misses the point of actually how progressive the sexuality in the book is, right? So like when they're in their Kimmering phases, there are places where you go and you can just have sex with people, right? Like there are situations where people do like choose people that they want to Kimmer with for life. And then there's people that are don't. So it's just like there's a lot of like positivity in the sexuality that I think is there, as well as like the power. Like if we look at Donald Trump and it was just like the sex and sex being about specifically about power in a lot of like heterosexual relationships, particularly when we're talking about politics, sex is about power.
Mm-hmm.
Like it doesn't happen in this book, and she takes it away. So I think she's trying to untangle, like, what do these relationships look like? What does this world look like if we can be sex positive? If we can remove sex being about power?
Mm-hmm. I understand. It's just a question I think that's worth asking about the world that she's constructing.
Hmm.
Not to say because you didn't do this, there's like. Your book is trash, or not because you didn't do this, what you're saying about gender isn't worth our attention and isn't going to, you know, make us think about things in a way that could be quite progressive and like quite profound. I think if we're also seeing literature as inspiring other literature, and we're mm-hmm. also seeing like especially science fiction, like world building, as inspiring other kinds of world building, that's like another question I would have about like, okay, so then what would it look like if there was no power in sex and there were also multiple like sexualities?
Mm-hmm. But I also think that this would lead you to ask those questions in another book, right? Like I think the sexuality that's there is so completely different and is so world-changing that like it would bring you to ask questions like that.
That's probably true. That is probably true.
And it's just like I also like it was written in 69. Like
no,
this is
I know.
This is like before women's lib got movement like movement happens. Like this is before like the feminist movement, like second wave feminism really was starting to get kicked off. Like she was really in the foreground, in the forefront of kind of like these ideas that were like about to like bubble up. That she is trying to like fight with and grapple with.
No, absolutely. Like I don't want to take anything away from this woman's brain, essentially. Yeah. Like her and her vision. Like I don't want to take anything away from that.
Yeah.
I think the fact that like it prompts asking these kind of questions is enough and like a beautiful, beautiful thing.
We hope you enjoyed this episode and it helps in some small way as we all look towards liberation. Ursula Le Guin passed earlier this year and we lost a titan of radical thought and stories. I want to leave you with a quote by her. Capitalism's power seems inescapable, but so too did the divine right of kings. The music is by the wonderful band Daka Braka. You should really check them out.
This has historically been the best way for us to start.
Is with a fight?
No, it's just... just to start talking and like forget about the editing and like what it's gonna end up sounding like.
You are a very intimidating person.
I'm not.
Yes, you are.
Well, you chose to do this podcast with me.
I know, for some unknown reason.